I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast.
Company that they moved from Chicago to New York for a year, and it was Arkin and Severin Darden, and
yes.
Barbara Harris, and all that original gang. So I got trained with some really good people.
So you were in New York at the time. So you were in New, pardon me, you were in New York, and then they came to visit.
Yeah, and they,
as it were.
Well, what happened is they came and did a Broadway show, and it got rave reviews, but it really only lasted 6 months because I think people were afraid to be turned to and say, "Who am I? What's my, what is our relationship?" They were used to coming with suits and ties and Broadway, and if you're in the front row of a Broadway theater, the stage is right here, so it's intimidating. So after a few months, they moved down to Greenwich Village, where the stage is this big, and you could have a beer and a cheeseburger.
Right.
And all the students from New York University were our audience.
That's amazing.
And one of them wanted to go back home, and they wanted to replace him. So without any training, I got hired.
Oh, my God.
Because I'd been a sketch actor and a bit of stand-up. And someone I knew told me about, they were looking for a guy, so I went down, and they pushed me on stage with Arkin and...
Holy crap.
And although I didn't know the rules of improvisation, I knew I could make things up. And then they hired me, so I stayed there for quite a while.
That's insane to me. With no, I should say, I started recording. Hi, everybody. Comedy on Vinyl. My guest this week is Paul Dooley. We're going to talk about all kinds of stuff because you are a comedy collector, but you also obviously a performer with some pedigree, as it were. So I want to talk about a little bit of everything. So. When you when did you go to New York? Because you're originally from West Virginia?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm from West Virginia. As I graduated college there in the State University, I went to New York. It was 1952. So that's a lot of years ago. And some actors will knock around for 1, 2, 3 years before they kind of click to where they can make a living being an actor. Sometimes less, sometimes more. It was 9 years before I gave up my part-time jobs. Not that I kept them all. I'd just go from a little show business to a lot of out of work. And to pay my rent, they had many, many different jobs. Often you get jobs in the evening so you go to auditions. Working at night. I've worked in a nightclub as a maitre d', as a doorman, as a car parker. Used to do market research on the phone with people.
Sure.
Anything that would come up, you know. Wherever you could find sold toys at Christmas and different stores. But then, you know, at first you might have 4 jobs a year, and then you have 6, and the next year you have 8. And at a certain point when it becomes not enough space in between them, or too much space, you say, okay, well, I don't have to be on unemployment anymore. I would work, you know, 20 weeks to get unemployment, then I'd get unemployment for 20 weeks.
And, all right.
And the rest of the year you try to work. But all the time I kept working, but it was just sparse, you know, and boring jobs and boring films for that matter.
Yeah.
But what happened to me was at a certain point, after having auditioned for maybe 50 times for commercials, I not only got one, but the company made me their spokesman, which means every residual is double scale because you're exclusive to to the product. Like the Gecko and like Flo. There's a better check involved because you're exclusive to them. So after doing 27 network commercials for them in a year, everybody in New York who were in the ad agency business, the casting directors at the ad agencies, they all knew who I was. So then I just really had a long career doing commercials as well as whatever plays I was doing on the side.
Yeah.
But doing plays was my hobby because you make so much more money doing residuals. But it's a great business, you know. You can make a commercial, you can run for 4 years, and you did it once, you know.
Right.
I once did a commercial with a voiceover where I said the word no, and it ran 4 years.
That's insane to me. Wow. Wait, what kind of sketch, so A, what was the state of sketch comedy in the 50s? And B, what kind of sketch were you doing with whom?
Well, there are a few clubs around New York. It was dying out as a form.
Okay.
Very few Broadway reviews did sketch comedy. I saw Bert Lahr once do what he was good at, which was sketch comedy. That was about 1953. I saw the Beyond the Fringe come over.
Oh.
I saw a couple of those, and Dudley, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore did one called Good Evening, just the two
mm-hmm.
of them. And they're very Python-esque. It's
yeah.
the same family. Then a group came over with John Cleese called Cambridge Circus. They
sure.
worked out of Cambridge and got their chops. But there are little clubs around town, and one was called Upstairs at the Downstairs. And I worked there in shows, but most of the sketch comedy came from when I worked with the Second City,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, almost all sketch comedy, because even though occasionally somebody would sing a song or
mm-hmm.
do what they used to call people pieces,
mm-hmm.
kind of something, a serious improv. But the audience is kind of trained to laugh in it. If you're trying to do a serious improv and they've seen others that are funny,
yeah.
they'll laugh anyway.
Uh-huh.
They'll laugh at straight lines.
Right.
But stand-up also gave me some experience with being in front of a crowd doing jokes. But I always wanted just to be a sketch comedian when I came to New York. But
really?
Of course, Gleason only had a couple more years, and Caesar only had a few more
sure.
years. And I wasn't well enough known to be involved in any of
mm-hmm.
those, but I used to go live to see Caesar and Jackie Gleason. God. They used to hand out tickets on the street for free on early
television.
Oh,
this is killing me. That's
amazing.
Want to
see a game show? They're out there on the streets.
Yeah.
Pages from NBC.
Yeah.
And I went to a lot of, I was in love with Caesar especially.
Mm-hmm.
And that gang. And I identified with Carl Reiner.
Mm-hmm.
Because I said, I don't think I look like a comedian or don't have red hair or freckles or something.
Sure.
Something that you might think odd looking.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, but I could be a great straight man because they're just as funny sometimes as the comic.
Sure.
Think of Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. So I admired him greatly and met him later. But the review form was dying out.
Yeah.
There'd been a lot of it in the 40s and 50s and all the way back to the Ziegfeld Follies in the 20s.
Sure.
Probably. Bert Lahr and people like that appeared on Broadway and those sketch comedies. It's just slightly elevated acting is between stand-up and regular acting.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're
mm-hmm.
just a little broader.
Yeah.
But it's good if you have an actor's kind of skills.
Mm-hmm.
Like underneath the obvious comedy talent of Caesar, not so much Caesar, but Gleason, he's a wonderful actor
mm-hmm.
underneath that.
Yes.
So that supports really interesting and funny sketch playing.
Mm-hmm.
Later, I fell in love with Harvey Korman,
mm-hmm.
doing
Absolutely.
The kind of thing I loved. And I worked with Carol Burnett many times. Her first real job in New York was in a summer resort where we did sketches all summer. And
oh, my God.
I was her husband from time to time.
Uh-huh.
So I knew her in those early days. And she got on a show people don't remember now. It was before she did the Carol Burnett show called The Gary Moore Show.
Uh-huh.
And she was she came on just as a comedy performer, but she was so dynamic, she pretty soon became the de facto star.
Amazing.
Because the audience loved her.
Amazing.
She used to, whenever they needed an extra hand in scenes or sketches, she would mention my name and I would go work on that show.
That's great.
But anyway, I made 80% of my money from commercials for 10 or 15 years, plus doing plays at the same time. But you have to do 8 shows a week to make the money there.
Right. Right. God.
So then I was just continuing with my combination of theater and making really a good living in commercials. And I did a play, an evening of comedy by Jules Pfeiffer, the cartoonist, for the Village Voice. And it was all a series of comic strips.
Mm-hmm.
So I played 30 characters, different comic strips, all through the evening. They were really short little scenes.
Oh, my God.
So Robert Altman saw me, put me in a movie, then he put me in 5 movies in a row. And I never looked back to
yeah.
what I did in New York, and I gave up the commercial business and became a film actor and sometimes television.
That's
moved
crazy.
Out of here.
That's crazy. Was there something... So the idea that sketch is sort of falling out of favor or kind of dying out at the time, in my brain, obviously being wrong... Sketches kept going the whole time. The sketch is my personal favorite, and I love it, but that obviously is a very egotistical way to look at
it. Because of Second City, because
okay.
once it started, then
mm-hmm.
they had a New York, they had a Toronto chapter with
yeah.
John Candy and all those folks, and they had a show out of here, and the Groundlings is kind of loosely based on the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
They sometimes write their sketches, but they're also good improvisers.
Yeah.
And the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in every medium-sized city, there's improv.
Sure.
And the advice to a young actor is you can't get a job. Find three friends, fool around with improv, mm-hmm. find a bar which will let you work there. You won't get paid.
Yep.
They'll hope you'll bring in your friends. Little corner of the room, a raised platform. Anybody can start a little improv group.
Yeah.
Before Belushi could get into Second City, he did that with two other guys.
It's nuts.
And they played in a bar around Chicago, and then Second City heard about him, and he mm-hmm. went over and auditioned. They were glad to have him.
Yeah.
But now it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous in college courses and everything.
Sure.
It started, Second City opened in 59, and so that's many, many years ago. And before that, there was the Compass Theater, which used improvisation with Nichols and May and
mm-hmm.
Shelley Berman. Before that, it was called Playwrights, and that was another group around the University of Chicago.
Okay.
Because the university didn't have any theater courses, so people who were like-minded, wanting to perform, started their own little groups on the side.
Okay. Know?
That's how it all really came about.
That's nuts. I don't think I knew that at all either. God. When did you... Okay, so I apologize, it's not my brain. For how long did you do stand-up, and then when did you do the album and why? Because I'm curious. Not everybody was cutting an album if they were doing stand-up at the time.
I'll tell you why. It's because Vaughn Meter, who did a great impression of Kennedy, but mm-hmm. of course it's not hard to do Kennedy. A lot of people can
mm-hmm.
do. I don't know exactly what kind of money it made or how many albums sold, but it was a monumental success
yes.
over any
yeah.
other spoken record before.
Mm-hmm.
So he was immediately a big, big hero, and then Kennedy was assassinated, and nobody heard of him again.
Right.
But for a brief time, he was the hottest guy around
yeah.
for a year or two. So when that was happening, there was a big record boom for mm-hmm. comedy. Before that, there hadn't been many comedy records. Red Fox, maybe.
Right.
Kind of a on the down low.
Mm-hmm.
But that was before Cosby and before all those people started
sure.
making records. And Newhart was at the beginning of that that craze, which was Bob Newhart and Shelley Berman in Chicago.
Sure.
But at around the time I joined Second City, there was a scene that was already being done left over from Chicago. It was called the Kennedy Khrushchev Debate.
Mm-hmm.
And an actor left who was playing Kennedy. Before he left, I said, how do you do Kennedy? So he just gave me a few tips, and I realized that it's not too much to it, you know.
Yeah.
It's got that kind of cool pausing thing he used to do. It was, yeah. And it's a kind of a, it's a New England accent, basically, Boston. So I was Kennedy, and Arkin was Khrushchev, and, you know. We had each had translators. So the audience would ask a question of the translator.
Oh, my God.
But, of course, the actor playing Khrushchev could hear it.
Yeah.
So while he's taking the suggestion, the guy's formulating his joke.
Uh-huh.
Sure, they're supposed to make it all up.
Sure.
But if you hear it 30 seconds early, you get an idea.
Mm-hmm.
So one night I'm doing Jack Kennedy in that routine. Two guys in the audience came backstage. You want to make a record of just Jack Kennedy talking scenes, you know?
Uh-huh.
I said, sure, $500 they gave me. Mm-hmm. A lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
And they sent me their scripts, and I said, Ed, there's some things there I think I could help by changing or some cuts I can make. They said, mm-hmm. no problem at all. So I made it. I never heard it. They didn't give me a copy. I forgot about it. I thought, if they can get Vaughn Meter's First Family,
mm-hmm.
what do they want me for?
Right, right.
So it maybe exists out there somewhere.
Good God, that's so annoying. Do you remember the names of the guys? Do you know anything about them at all?
I know one writer who's named Dee Caruso.
Mm-hmm.
D-E-E Caruso.
Mm-hmm.
Man, if you can find him on the
all
line,
right, I'm going to do some
might
hunting.
Find
I'm
Kennedy
going to do
record.
Some hunting. This
and he
gonna...
had a partner whose name I've forgotten.
Okay.
Because I'm so damned old.
But
I was riding high on being in Second City, and I was all still doing my commercials.
Sure.
I had a feeling this was just a one-off thing where people may or may not listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't mind. Anyway, after Robert Altman found me in this thing and liked me, I said to my friends at the time, if I don't do anything wrong, I may be in a number of his movies, because he mm-hmm. he likes to use a sort of a stock company or a repertoire.
Right.
Repertory company. Sure enough, I did 5 movies with him. So he became a big part of my life.
Yeah.
Oddly, my most successful movie wasn't with him. It was a few years into my Altman years, which was Breaking Away, of course, with Peter Yates,
mm-hmm.
a director from England. somebody told me, a reporter once, that it took a kid who was born in Yugoslavia and came here as a child, Steve Tesic, to write it, and an English guy to direct it, mm-hmm. and do a quintessential American Family that still holds up today.
Yeah.
That really had a good look in American culture.
It's brilliant.
I love that.
And that's really been my calling card ever since, mm-hmm. Breaking Away. I still got jobs in that movie that people remember.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I played fathers about 40 times.
Uh-huh. I actually realized today, this is going to be the weirdest thing, and I'm going to have people of a certain age annoyed with me, that I've never seen 16 Candles. I've never seen it. People will be like, how the hell are you your age? And you've never, I've never seen it.
Well, it's a blank spot.
Yeah,
you know,
I have those. I have.
I didn't
those.
Read War and Peace either.
Right. Well, there you go. I mean, War and Peace is a little more lengthy than 16 Candles, I'm guessing.
Well, it's very iconic in a certain range of
for sure.
ages. If I meet women under 30, they know me from 16 Candles.
Mm-hmm.
Meet people over 30, they know me from Breaking Away.
Yeah, yeah. What about your... Okay, so then you did your second comedy album.
My only.
Your only actual comedy album.
Well, no, Kennedy, you was, actually Kennedy was the second.
The one that actually people have heard, that I have heard before and really enjoyed.
Yeah, it's called Paul Dooley Booked Solid. Some people in those days had a trademark. Bob Newhart did a lot of telephone conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So did Shelley Berman,
mm-hmm.
the invisible person on the other end of the line.
Yeah.
I had one routine. Most of my stuff was written for me by a very brilliant comedy writer. And as I worked with him over the years, I kind of, by osmosis, picked up the idea of how you can write comedy.
Okay.
At first, I just thought I admired it, but I could never write a joke or write something funny.
Sure.
But he had written a routine, which was me reading from a book of old fairy tales or old folk tales. And one was from a Slavic kind of story.
Uh-huh.
Passed down from generation to generation. And here's the first joke I say. And... traditionally, this is how the story was told.
Mm-hmm.
Turn to the first page. And they laugh, and I say, you've heard it? With the benefit of those who don't speak Kurdish, which is what we call it,
mm-hmm.
I'll continue. But then I read this nonsense stuff, and then everything I translated shows that I knew didn't know the language at all. You know?
I love it.
Like, for example, he says, once there lived a lovely and intelligent young girl, or old horse. I'm a little rusty with this translation. But it was a wonderful routine.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to go on stage with a book that I would pretend to use. I'd pretend to be reading.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it would look weird. I'd be stuck with a book. What do I do with it?
Uh-huh.
So I brought on about 6 books and allowed, found a way to each routine came from a book.
Different. Okay.
Well, here's something on the Kennedy Brothers, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's something. You know,
I love it.
I used the book as a prop, and
yeah.
that was my sort of gimmick, if you will. There's some stuff on that record, though, which is totally visual. And
yeah.
I never thought when I did it, it mattered. But
yeah.
I play in a Shakespearean routine. I play a guy who is told by the princess that if you can fool my father, he admires clever people, mm-hmm. then he'll give you my hand in marriage. So I go and pretend to be the court jester. And it doesn't work out too well. And so he finally, I reveal myself, who I am. I'm a lovely daughter. He says, then you may have her. You've mm-hmm. got a lot of imagination or something. So then I have the, on my right hand is the Duke, and my left hand is the princess, who's my bride. They're very close to me. They're invisible, but they're close mm-hmm. to me. And I say, my heart doth sing, we two may wed. All hail the Duke, pull out my sword. The Duke is, and I close, open my arms, and I say, dead, because
mm-hmm.
I've accidentally stabbed him. I'm sorry, sir, I had no idea you. And then I say, oh, put aside this foul sword, this blade that has slain thee, and I back up into my girlfriend. You're standing a little close, sweetheart, and then she falls dead. Then I step forward and say, alas, both lie betrayed. How soon life passes. I sheath my blade. Oh, I must get glasses. But all that stabbing on a record.
Yeah, it just plays. There's so many records like that at the time where I'm like, the audience is loving the hell out of this. I'm missing so much. I mean, Steve Martin, same. There's some bits that he did on his brilliant albums that I'm like, oh, yeah. No idea what he just did.
And he always did funny business.
Yes, right.
Moved around.
So much moving around, so much activity and energy.
Well, at that time, because I was into comedy,
mm-hmm.
I used to buy a lot of albums.
Yes.
You know, just this morning, because you sent me an email saying you already have more vinyl than you can store.
Unfortunately, yes.
I just gave to my Pilates instructor, who mm-hmm. I went to my session today at the noon, and I was telling him what I was doing, meeting you, and maybe some of your viewers might want some of my vinyl. He said, I'll take them. So I brought him over here, and I showed him the boxes. They're in my garage right here. And he said, I'll take them. And there's 75 records there.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of Broadway musicals.
It's amazing.
A lot of comedy.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in there.
Cosby and Newhart.
Mm-hmm.
Stiller and Mira, who are people I used to write mm-hmm. for, as a matter of fact. And a whole lot of them. Flip Wilson. And whatever else there was. I have a disc that was made first for radio. Then I think it became a movie. One woman movie. She's trapped in a room. It's almost like Twilight Zone,
mm-hmm.
but I believe it was a feature. Agnes Moorehead was her name. She mm-hmm. was a famous character
yeah,
actress.
Yeah.
And it's a panicked woman trapped in a house where there's a man in the attic, or she hears him, and she keeps calling different people to help her, but she can't get anyone. It's called Sorry, Wrong Number.
Why does that sound familiar?
Well, it was on radio.
Okay.
Maybe something like the Lux Radio Theater with Cecil B. DeMille as a host. But it's not the size of a normal LP, so it's a little, so it might be another speed.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it's all with my Pilates teacher. Mm-hmm. But he was interested because there were Ravel's Bolero and some classical stuff. There was Crosby, Stills, and Nash. This wonderful guy is Paul Simon, Simon and Garfunkel.
Mm-hmm.
He had Bridge Over Troubled Waters album.
Uh-huh.
So I gave him everything because I thought he would only want a few, but he just went away with them.
That's amazing.
It's great.
As long as you still got a copy of Book Solid, that's all I care about. Yeah. I really want to have a signed copy of that. Not
he
to
took three or four
you.
For his friends.
Did he?
I have
Good.
Five left. At the time, they gave me a box with two dozen in it.
Uh-huh.
So they've been sitting in my garage or my...
Wait, that's it? That's all they gave you at the time? It's in
well,
the 60s,
I, you know,
right?
Yeah, I guess if I called him and said I ran out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I don't know. I didn't give too many of them away.
Right, right, right. It's a really fun album. It's also got a really great cover. Like, there are not a lot of albums at the time that I necessarily give a crap about. Because it's funny, because you dig through. I tried last year and failed to listen to a comedy album a day. Because at some point, you want to put a gun in your mouth. It's so bad. It just it gets so much bad comedy.
There were some very good things.
There's
Bob Newhart's
really
stuff
things.
Was great. He made
yes.
three or four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Shelley Berman made...
Yeah, I love Shelley Berman.
I forget what the first... It was the edge of Shelley Berman or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the second was the side of Shelley Berman. And the
yeah,
front
there's
of
inside
Shelley
and
Berman.
Outside. And yes, there's
inside Shelley Berman,
outside. Yeah.
On the edge of...
Uh-huh.
And he approached it as Newhart did, less as a joke teller who just does joke, which is a standard stand-up comic. You go from joke to joke with
right.
not very much logic. He was doing acting scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Newhart would be on teaching a woman how to drive,
mm-hmm.
and Newhart would be talking to, Shelley Berman would talk to people who weren't there.
Yes.
So those are really sketches from one person, and mm-hmm. they were actor-oriented. And that's what my act was sort of like.
Right.
I found ways to get into those characters.
Was that something that you genuinely enjoy? I mean, I'm assuming you enjoyed doing it, but who knows? I mean, was it something that you got to flex some acting muscles that you wouldn't otherwise get to flex? I'm curious.
That's why a lot of people get into stand-up. They might want to be actors,
yeah,
but they can't break into it. But mm-hmm. You can always go to the corner, a little corner of a nightclub and
yeah.
do it for free, stand up and try things out. I just met this guy who was a sort of a genius comedy writer, but he was a school teacher at the time. And he showed me some of his stuff, and it's really, really brilliant. So it was so slow that we took almost a year before I had 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then if I went to a club and did 30 minutes and they wanted a show for later in the evening,
uh-huh.
I said, I don't have a show for later in the evening. I just have to do that again, but I usually warned them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we'd work, you know, I'd see him every Saturday and go out to his home in Long Island for maybe 3 hours. And you work on a lot of ideas before you get the one you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took us forever to build up an act.
Yeah.
While not being really qualified, because I started doing these routines around New York, not in major clubs in New York, but on the periphery, like in Long Island and Connecticut.
Okay.
They called club dates. I'd make $25 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a club date, and there was an audience of about 30 accountants, CPAs and their wives.
Okay.
But it turned out they really liked it. They sat still for it. There was a lot of people in nightclubs make noise, and they have other things in mind,
mm-hmm.
and they're drinking.
Sure.
This was just a little meeting of these people, entertainment, and they loved me. I got a call from a guy, and he says, my brother was there when you did your routines for the CPAs,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a manager and an agent. I'd like you to come to my office. We'll talk about it. So I went up, and I showed him some of my material, and he handled Jonathan Winters, who at that time was on Jack Parr about every 2 weeks.
Okay, sure,
Jack
yeah.
Parr loved him.
Mm-hmm.
He would make Parr break up.
With the twig.
Yeah.
That's such a good bit.
So I go and audition, and then next week I'm at the Tonight Show. And all these guys in town who have had 5-10 years experience
uh-huh.
trying to get on the Tonight Show. So it was a fluke in a way.
Yeah.
I showed them my best routine, which was Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's funny. Yeah, what else you got? Now you just see a talent coordinator if you go to those places.
Oh, okay.
Or
yeah.
they have to come and see you in a club.
Sure.
But there's Jack Parr and two of his people, so they're probably writers, two or three
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
Maybe a producer.
Oh, my God.
So every time I'd finish a routine, they'd say, what else you got? And I showed him 30 minutes. Then he'd say, what else you got? And I didn't have anything else.
Yeah.
But they've been very nice. They laughed when, here and there. It's never great when it's a small audience.
Uh-huh.
But I've been working with this writer, David, on an idea, because I used to do the voice of my nephew when he was 4 years old or five.
Uh-huh.
A kind of a kid's voice, just between us. And he said, we read in Time magazine about a trend which meant younger politicians are now becoming senators, congressmen, mayors, governors. And it was about Bobby Kennedy and Jack mm-hmm. as senators. Used to be all politicians were 55 or 60 before
sure.
they got there.
Sure.
Then suddenly this new breath of air comes along, and the mayor of Cleveland and the mayor of this town and the governor of that place.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I said, let's write a routine about this kid's voice you do, but he's president, because they're getting younger and younger.
Of course.
So we pushed that idea. So we'd started talking about nothing. It was really on paper. It was talked about a few jokes. And so I did that, and they said, great. I only did about a minute and a half of it because they didn't even have an ending. They said, you're on next Thursday.
Oh.
So then we finished it. But it was a very good chain, a very routine, a very topical. Eisenhower was president. Nixon was vice president. James mm-hmm. Haggard was the press secretary. John Foster Dulles was the secretary of state. So mm-hmm. those are the names I was dealing with.
Yeah.
At the end of the routine, I say, well, that's the end of my first day. Maybe I'll go now play with my little friends. Let's see. Johnny Foster Dulles just ran away from home again because they always kidded about him being on a plane somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Haggard is out on his paper route. I was the press secretary. Dickie Nixon won't play unless he can be the president. So I guess I'll just take the day off and go play miniature golf, which is what Eisenhower was doing all
uh-huh.
the time, like Trump is now. Every president is criticized for playing.
Yeah, yeah.
it was a very funny routine. I went back 2 or 3 times. And once David was out of town, he had gotten a job somewhere, and I had a week's notice to do another visit there and have the material, and you want to always try it out somewhere.
Sure.
So Alan Alda was a friend of mine. He's a wonderful comedy writer, and we met several times, wrote a routine
mm-hmm.
For my last visit there. And Alan is very funny. His father was in burlesque. His father was a good-looking guy who would sing, here's a pretty girl, like a melody.
I had no idea.
He was a straight man,
uh-huh.
and the guy who was the crooner, he would
amazing.
Often sing. But so he spent a lot of time backstage around mm-hmm. burlesque comics, and he's very knowledgeable and a wonderful human being, and really understands comedy really well. Anyway, as a kid, I thought I loved jokes, but I had no idea I could ever. So 40 years later, I get the hang of how it's all constructed.
And mm-hmm.
The magic 1-2-3 twist, you know.
Yeah.
And just caught up on it by listening to so many comedians. And
sure.
They're teachers in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Matty Murphy used to listen to Cosby and go to school and do his jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Rock used to listen to Eddie Murphy and go to school and do mm-hmm. his jokes. And all those guys would, you know, just steal ideas from places and try them out.
Of course, yeah.
And so if you're young, you want to break into that, you listen to all the other comics. You try to buy their albums. And I've had people who said, I memorized your album along with all these other guys.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think I was anywhere with it, like some of those people. But there's some pretty good writing in it.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
I had a chance after a year and a half, maybe 2 years on the road, to join Second City, and I so liked the idea of having another human being, and you lock eyes with them,
mm-hmm.
and you can forget the audience in a way.
Yes, yeah.
What's really hard to stand up there by yourself, because if they're drunk or if they're drinking,
oof, yeah,
or if they're noisy mm-hmm. or competitive, the boyfriend in that situation doesn't want that girl to love that comedian too much.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
because she's laughing and you're getting the feeling she loves that guy. He's funny and she loves him. And so that's why most, almost all hecklers are men.
Yeah.
And I also used to do magic, and they would want to say, the girls would go, ooh, and ah, how did you do that?
Uh-huh.
He's saying, ah, it's probably something up his sleeve, or
uh-huh.
he has a wire. They always think they know.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I did the magic for adults, and guy yelled out to me once, I missed something disappear. He says, it's up your sleeve. And I said, up yours. But mostly I did it for kids and as a clown.
Really?
That was another.
Oh,
I couldn't join SAG after an Equity,
mm-hmm.
my first couple of years there, I figured I'd be sort of in show business, so I did clown dates. And,
holy cow.
Because I learned to do juggling early.
Mm-hmm.
Just taught myself. I lived on a gravel road, and I used to pick up stones and juggle.
Just juggle those.
But if I dropped one, it didn't matter if I picked that one up. I'd just pick another one.
Yeah, right, right.
And I was met Don Knotts in my college. He was a senior. I was a freshman. And he was already an accomplished comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught me some magic tricks. And so then I kept studying it myself. And so I was able to use that in a clown act.
That's amazing. Did I read correctly that you replaced Art Carney in The Odd Couple at one point?
Yeah, I was in The Odd Couple, which Mike Nichols directed and Neil Simon wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a poker player.
Mm-hmm.
I auditioned to be one of the poker players, which I was. And they have a number of scenes, then they go off stage and aren't there for a while.
Yeah,
and they come
yeah.
back near the end. But they said they wanted me to understudy Art Carney.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched every performance from the wings when we were out of town, and I kept reading my script and learning, but I learned mostly by listening to them.
Sure.
And we were in Boston, Wilmington, Delaware, and Washington, D.C., and we came to New York. And Art never missed a performance,
mm-hmm.
but Art was a drinker.
Oh, all right.
And we didn't really know that about him. But then once we opened, and we got rave reviews, of course, I looked out a peephole and first week, there's Sinatra, there's Jack Benny, there's Jack Lemmon, there's
crap.
Just everybody. All the important people. When it's a hit, they like to get tickets that
course,
week.
Of course.
The first few weeks. What a thrill for me. And they'd come backstage and they talked to Carney because he was a star.
Sure.
And Matha wasn't yet a star.
Yeah.
Although Matha became a star from that show.
Mm-hmm.
And he was great in it. But Art had done Ed Norton.
Sure.
And people lined up to speak to him. Anyway, shortly after we opened, he missed one night, but he didn't phone in and say, I won't be there, I'm not feeling well. He just didn't come.
Oh, crap.
So 5 minutes to curtain, the guy says, you better put on his clothes, not yours.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And he missed about once every 2 weeks, and so I got a whole practice of doing it with Matthau.
Mm-hmm.
And then one time he didn't come in, and he didn't come in the next night, he didn't come in the next night. And they were frantic because his agent didn't know where he was. He was going through a divorce. He probably lived in a hotel.
Sure.
Nobody could find Carney. finally they found out that he put himself into what we call rehab now, but in those days they called it something else, detox or dry, a place where you dry out.
Yeah, yeah.
But he never did come back, and he had been an alcoholic, and you don't know. I met him from time to time afterwards, and a very nice guy, very sweet guy. And that's how I got to do that for a while.
Yeah.
But then I left it to go do a pilot out here, which didn't sell, out in California.
Did you do any TV work other than Tonight? Did you do any TV work in New York, like any sitcoms or Playhouse shows, anything like that?
I did some dramas. I would usually have two lines or four lines or six lines. I was once on a show that was popular called The Defenders.
Mm-hmm.
It was E.G. Marshall and Robert Reed, father-son team. I had a very decent part in that. I was a playwright. And Cloris Leachman was my attorney.
Amazing.
It was based on a real situation where a critic had been so mean to the playwright. I don't know what he said, really. I can't remember anymore. But in addition to saying it wasn't a good play, he might have said he's an idiot or something.
Sure.
The guy sued him for slander.
Okay.
So the writers made it into an episode of a TV show.
Wow.
So I played that playwright, and Cloris Leachman was my lawyer, who was, I think, one of the best actresses we ever had.
Absolutely.
If you think of her doing the Last Picture Show, and also being able to work in those Mel Brooks films, broad comedy, she can do anything. She's really great. Later, I worked with her in a movie or two, but she's really wonderful. I'll never forget. She almost stole the movies from Young Frankenstein and and from High Anxiety.
Yes, absolutely.
Everything she did, she would just.
I don't know how. I don't know what it is.
You lost my boyfriend.
How she's so magnetic. There's something. It's great. Inexplicable to me. Her and, I mean, you mentioned Harvey Korman earlier, who I've had the fortune to imitate on stage because I did play his Blazing Saddles character on stage once, which was a lot of fun.
In what show?
We do this show every month where we do a stage reading of an 80s or a 70s movie. Yeah, and we do a stage reading. I dressed up. I did the full mustache and everything, and I was Harvey Korman for 2 hours, and it was the greatest experience I've ever had.
Oh, God. It was so funny.
Yeah. You can only imitate, though. You'll never come close.
I remember he said, get me every... And he had 20 names for villains. Gunslinger, cut purse, everything you could find in the dictionary.
Muggers, buggerers. So many, there's 20 different... And Methodists is how he ends it.
Oh, God, it was funny. Anyway, I almost admired him more than anybody as a sketch actor.
Yeah. Do you still have a spot in your heart for sketch? Is it still a thing you either would go see or perform in?
When I moved out here, I hooked up with a few of the people who were still around who had been in the original company of Second City. Most people don't remember them, but Second City people all know who they are. Severin Darden was one, kind of a genius. Mina Kolb was one of the first women. Barbara Harris is one of the other women. Paul Sand, who's a great mime, who studied with Marcel Marceau, and a number of them. Richard Libertini is a friend of mine, and he was an improviser. And we used to go down to the Promenade, which is 3rd Street near Santa Monica, near the ocean. And every Saturday, we'd go in and do an hour and a half or 2 hours, and then we'd leave. Another group would come on.
Oh, man.
And a group ahead of us was Odin Kirk and David Cross, working on Mr. Show.
Holy cow.
Before it became a TV show.
Amazing.
I did that for 5 years every Saturday.
That's so good.
For nothing.
Yeah.
Just for fun. And if any one of us ever had a job or a conflict or cold, we just didn't go.
Yeah.
They worked. They called someone else up.
Oh, my God. I wish you'd do it again.
Louis Arquette was in that company.
Really? Yeah.
Not only does Louis Arquette have 4 or 5 children who are well-known actors.
Yeah.
His father was Cliff Arquette.
Yes.
Who played the funny guy on the... Hollywood Squares. Charlie Weaver was his stage name, but
yes,
it was Cliff Arquette. Lewis brought me a picture of his grandfather, who was in vaudeville, who was another Arquette.
Holy cow, I didn't know that.
That's an Alsatian name, he told me.
I didn't know they
went
French,
back that Alsatian.
Far. But Alsatian.
Who knows Alsatians?
I didn't know it went back that far. I didn't know that the family went
back.
That's
4 generations.
Jeez, that's insane to me. They're like...
We used to do a poetry thing, and he would always do a haiku. Make it up.
Oh, my God.
we used to sit down in chairs, five or six of us, and the person who went first would have to make something up. But the second guy had time to think about it.
Sure.
And the third guy had more time. Lewis was the fourth guy, and I would see him counting his fingers. He's making up a haiku.
Of course.
Which is supposed to look like off the cuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I used to specialize in fake iambic pentameter, and I used to do
so good
Shakespeare. And I did that a lot. That was my thing in Second City.
That's amazing.
Barbara Harris, who didn't like doing the poetry, would always just make an A-B-A-B rhyme, and that's most anybody can do
okay,
that.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And at the end of it, she would say, a Hallmark card. Arkin used to imitate a guy named Robert W. Service, who wrote a famous poem years and years and years ago about Alaska called A Bunch of the Boys Were Whooping It Up in a Malamute Saloon. This is an old-timey.
Okay.
Before he was ever an actor, he must have heard this.
Yeah, yeah.
He used to imitate that rhythm because Alan is a musician, of course.
Uh-huh.
And I had a penchant for kidding around Shakespeare. So we always picked something we could. One guy always did Sandburg, Chicago, City of the Big Shoulders, fog moving in on little cat's feet. We'd sprinkle that stuff in. It was very successful.
That's so good.
The people who saw us from NYU down in Greenwich Village, they were like amazing. They'd never seen human beings stand up and make things up.
Yeah,
know? And even though sometimes we were remembering it from the night before.
Right.
It still had the feel of being improvised because when you re-improvise it, it's still loose.
Mm-hmm.
And if we learn it because it's a solid sketch, we still have the freedom to change within it.
For sure.
You know, we have a beginning, middle, and end, and you put anything in there you want if you think of it.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd never seen anything like this before. It looks less like acting and more like life.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were just sitting ducks for us. We'd have a full house every night. There's about 200 seats. Later, that room became, under the name of The Bottom Line, became a jazz, a kind of a rock and roll room.
Mm-hmm.
New musicians every night of the week.
Yeah.
Just the opening act and a closing act.
It's crazy.
And that went on for about 20 years. Across the street from The Bottom Line was Folk City, where Dylan got discovered.
Okay.
Just right on the corner. But I lived there 30 years, and I've been out here a little over 30 years in California.
Well, you got a taste of both. That's crazy to me, though. Just to be there during the period you were, in terms of like comedy development, to be here at a time to not just work with Robert Altman, but to work with Robert Altman. I mean, that's.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it brought you out here, but that's not bad. That's crazy.
Well, Robert Altman was an odd guy.
Uh huh.
If he didn't follow the rules of show business usually.
Right.
He didn't like to audition people. He'd see them somewhere. He'd meet someone at a party.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Texas making a thing called Brewster McCloud. He goes to a museum, and the guide in the museum, never have acted in her life, was Shelley Duvall. He thought she looked great.
Yeah.
She has a very cinematic face. She has high cheekbones.
Yes.
She has big eyes, big kind of horse teeth almost, long neck. He put her in six or seven movies. She became Olive Oil. And she told me when she was in middle school, they kidded her and called her Olive Oil. Because she's so skinny.
Oh, my God.
And she did great in that movie.
Yeah.
Well, he cast me as the father of the bride. I was a kind of a Kentucky, redneck type.
Mm-hmm.
I ran a diesel truck stop. But my daughter was marrying into money. And in the movie, A Wedding, they're rich people around the lake in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like poor and rich. Although we were a little bit nouveau riche, had a chain of diesel truck stops. They had 10 stars in it. Carol Burnett was my wife in it, and we were just hillbillies in the way.
Nuts. Yeah.
So the next time he does a movie, I play the lead. And I'd hardly been in any movies. One from him.
Yeah.
The romantic comedy. A part that Jack Lemmon could have done.
Uh-huh.
But I'm in New York after I did a wedding, and my friend says, you're in Variety. What? He said, get Variety. It's on page 45. So I look at it, and there's an ad, and it says, Robert Altman's newest production, a romance with Paul Dooley, and there's a picture of me and Marta Heflin, who is Van Heflin's niece, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know I was going to be in his next movie.
Oh, my God.
I called him up. He said, well, I was going to tell you sometime.
Holy shit. shit.
So he promoted me into kind of a bumbling romantic comedy.
Uh-huh.
And the third movie, he asked me to help write it. Now, most people don't give you a writing assignment if you've never written.
No.
He never saw a word I'd written. I'd done a lot of writing before that. But he didn't know that. But he just thinks, well, he's an amusing guy. So he had a script, but the studio didn't like it, so had me freshen it up, as they say.
Yeah.
Or pitch, what do you call it?
Punch up.
Punch it up. So I started from scratch, and I put what I wanted to in there, and we did. It was called Health. The movie was called Health.
Yeah.
To my mind, not a great movie, but Glenda Jackson, Lauren Bacall, Carol Burnett, Jim Garner.
That's a hell of an adventure either way. I just love that you're thrown into it. It's like, well, at least I can say I've done this. That's insane to me. Even if you don't like it at the end of the day.
Well, I knew he was going to do Popeye next, and I thought, it'd be nice to have a small part.
Sure.
And I knew he liked me, so I'd probably maybe do something. He said, you're going to be a Popeye, but I don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And finally he said, I want you to play Wimpy. And I thought, oh, wow, Wimpy should be a real fat guy. Mm-hmm. Maybe with a fat nose.
Yeah.
His drawing is kind of, you know.
For sure, yeah.
Very cartoony looking. So I was a little skeptical about how well I would do, but hell, I'm not going to turn down the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave me a fat suit to wear.
Yeah.
I had big shoes and had a little tiny derby. And the drawing of Wimpy in the comic strip is three lines, three strokes of a pen.
Uh-huh.
One under his nose are three little hairs.
Yes, right, yeah.
Coming out of his hat are three more little hairs, just a stroke of a pen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you do that, really?
Mm-hmm.
So they made a very small mustache. It was kind of, they dyed my hair red. You didn't see much of it because it was just sideburns.
Sure, sure.
They dyed Robin's hair red because nobody knew what color Popeye's hair
was.
Yeah,
right.
And they raised my eyebrows up higher because my eyebrows go straight across, and we made them a little more quizzical looking.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it turned out it was through costuming and makeup and one thing and another, it worked out a pretty good image of him. By no way, if he likes you, he really trusts you. He said, I'm having a hard time thinking of a guy for Popeye who's Giesel, who's a pushcart vendor, obviously a Jewish man called Giesel. And because when the comic strip came out in the 20s, you know, there was much more of a categorizing of people.
Sure, so sure, sure.
Very, very kind of a cliche picture of the Lower East Side of New York. Guys with push carts were selling clothes or whatever. He said, you know, it's a guy with a long nose and a big beard who can do dialects. I said, I know the perfect guy, Dick Libertini. I said, if you want, I'll get him to send down a reel of the things he's done. He said, no, if you think he's good, that's fine. No director ever says that.
No, of course not.
No. You can't recommend anybody.
Yeah.
I'd have recommended my friends all this time, but
right.
They don't want you to. Casting director's upset.
Mm-hmm.
Producers, they all want to make their own choices, but he trusted me. And I also got another guy in that show that
amazing.
I knew.
That was a
kind of a tedious shoot because it ended up being 6 months.
Ooh, that I did not know.
Away from home in the island of Malta in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea.
And so much of it was built fresh for the movie, right? It was just, there was a ton of, it was just...
Built from scratch, a whole town. A beautiful town.
It's insane.
When I talked to other people who did the movie,
we
didn't feel we were in Malia, a small city in Malta. We felt we lived in Sweet Haven, which is the town built for the movie.
Yeah.
Because 12 hours a day, you're in Sweet Haven.
Of course.
You only sleep in Malta.
Yeah, yeah. Oh
my God. The guy was a genius, the guy who built it. Built it from scratch. He went there 6 months early and built a whole... This was a bay... And instead of being a beach, it was a tumble of rocks where if you walked along the beach, each step would be up or down.
Yeah.
So every house would have to have legs of different sizes.
Mm-hmm.
He got a big crew of Maltese carpenters, and he just supervised them.
Wow.
It made about 20 buildings.
Yeah.
There were bridges, and if a house was 4 feet lower than the next house, they put a little stairwell with a rope banister. It was beautiful.
See, that's
one of the best things about it is...
Mm-hmm.
Makeup, wardrobe, and the set. It's just a great place.
I mean, it's so funny. History will look on it differently in years, and it looks on it differently now. Like, people have different... Some people absolutely love it. Some people are like, what the hell was he thinking? But it's that level of effort is a genuine piece of Hollywood that doesn't exist anymore because it'd all be CG. And I'm not trying to sound like an old grandpa about it, but no. I'm just saying.
And also, a few years back it started, but you could make a miniature of a town.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have to go to that town.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If it was a little specialized, what Sweet Heaven looked like was a Disney house or the roof, every roof caved in the middle.
Uh-huh.
They're slightly crooked.
Yeah.
Except they built it from new lumber, which they got from, I believe, Germany or Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are no trees at all on Malta.
So yeah.
It's a big rock in the middle of the ocean.
That's nuts.
And then once it was all done, they had to paint it to distress it so it was all gray.
Yeah.
But if there was color, they were muted like a barber pole. It mm-hmm. wouldn't be bright red. It would be muted.
So much
and before all the shops that the eye doctor would have a picture of a big symbol of glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And a shoemaker would have a shoe outside hanging up over the door because you go way back, more people were illiterate.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the idea, like we sell eyeglasses here.
Yeah.
Even if you can't read.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So it was really a beautiful set. Just great.
It's wonderful. I forgot to ask you about the electric company. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the electric company.
You know, a year after I did that job, I found out Carl Reiner had recommended me. I never knew it in the beginning.
Really?
I had done a show that David Frost produced, and the star of it was Peter Ustinov. It was meant to be a variety show because Peter was so good with voices.
Yes, yeah.
And Carl Reiner directed it, and he also appeared in it. And I was one of the sketch actors. And whenever you're rehearsing a sketch, you sometimes will throw another line in, or you have another reaction, or, you know, could I say this? Or there's a little bit of freedom in it because sketches are basically humorous ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd throw things in, never thought much about it. Once they needed an ending for a scene, and I was in it with Carl, and we had a dress rehearsal audience there. It was like hangers-on, like 20 people in suits, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a dress rehearsal. They were using the Ed Sullivan Theater. And he said, well, that's not a good ending. That ending doesn't work, but we'll think of something by tonight
mm-hmm.
when we do it in front of an audience. And then I told him backstage, maybe you could say this instead of that. He said, oh, Paul Dooley has a good idea. This will be the ending. So most people aren't that generous.
No.
Make it look like their idea. So he had this idea that I could write. So when he came onto Sesame Street, they asked a lot of celebrities in the first season, just come on and recite the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Carol Burnett did it.
Yeah.
And Carl came on and recited the alphabet. And sometimes you try to dramatize it if you want to. Oh. So they said, you know, we really have a trouble getting good writers here because anybody who writes comedy moves to California and works with people like you.
Yeah.
So he said, well, Paul Dooley's a very funny guy. You should get him. He's a good writer. But he never had seen a word I'd ever written. And Altman never saw a word I'd ever written. He wanted me to rewrite the script. So sometimes your personality can get you places, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed that. I felt, I told my friends, finally, with my comedy background, I was doing something, I was using my talent for good instead of evil.
Uh-huh.
Because I thought if you helped only a few children learn, you know, make it easier for them to learn.
Yeah.
To read, that was very nice. I took it very seriously, and I thought of a lot of techniques to help. And one of our charges we were given is there's a percentage of our population that are illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
Even still, they either skip school or quit or get thrown out or whatever. But they grow up not learning to know much about reading, except how to sign their name or something.
Sure, yeah.
They said if they sit with their kids, they might, by osmosis, just watching,
yeah,
without being embarrassed. They'll never go back to school if they're
sure.
25 years old or 30. But if you sit with your kid and this information is coming at you, the techniques of learning,
yeah,
they might help them learn to read. So they said if you want to put in things for the adults as well as the children, which the Muppets did all the time.
Sure.
Very hip, those Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
They probably told the same thing. I mean, Sesame was just ABC and 1, 2, 3, but we were words and sentences and all that.
Yeah.
But I took it seriously, and I tried to find a lot of ways to do it which were kind of sneaking up on the kids. We don't want it to look like a classroom.
Yeah.
Because we're not reaching the kids who will learn to read normally.
Sure.
We're reaching into the inner city, and Cosby was really donating his time for scale, almost nothing, to help his people. And Rita Moreno is doing the same with the Hispanic audience.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to reach people having trouble learning to read.
Yeah.
Or don't go to school often enough, or hate school, whatever it is.
Sure.
When you entertain them, but you hope that you sneak in the message of reading.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to make it not look like a lecture.
Yeah.
So I come up with a lot of different techniques. One that I liked was I wrote a sample sketch, and I talked to all these writers. I had like 6 or 7 writers. So I want to try this. It's Jennifer of the Jungle was this one character we had. She's teaching her gorilla to read. The gorilla will never learn to read, but as he fails at it, the kids looking over the gorilla's shoulder will feel they're smarter than the gorilla is.
All right, yeah.
Without actually them realizing you're teaching them. Because she would just say, it's cat. He'd go, bleh. No, cat, go, yeah. He never did anything. It was like White Fang, which used to be Soapy Sales, dog, or wolf, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I came up with techniques where it didn't look like teaching, but it was.
Yeah.
Now they have a new Sesame Street, a new electric company, heavy on hip-hop music.
That's awesome.
And they're using some of those same techniques.
Yeah? Oh, yeah. That's good.
I wanted to heck one character, I want him to be a junkie for reading, so we could use him as the one who was hardcore reader.
Uh-huh.
And I made it Morgan Freeman, who I called him Easy Reader, and he was dressed like Easy Rider.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a child chef named Julia grown up, because I wanted to show recipes which have print. And I named a guy who was supposed to unscramble sentences by teaching where the period goes if at the end, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
I called him Fargo North Decoder. So most of my characters and departments, which were repeated, were kind of jokes, joke titles.
Yeah. The Easy Reader thing. So, were you involved in the production too? Is it just writing?
The truth is, for some odd reason, the management there, two producers, were crazy about me. I think they might have seen me a second. I don't know why exactly, but they had so much faith in them. They said, "Could you possibly be in the show and also write the scripts?" I said, "I don't think so, because you know these other writers. I got to meet with them every day,
yeah.
And they got to go through it and improve them. And well, could you maybe direct the sketches?" I said, "I'd love to, but
yeah.
If someone else will write them."
Yeah, yeah.
So they wanted me to be the Orson Welles guy, and so I did voiceovers though. If an animation guy would come in and he'll show us his idea for a 30-second or a minute animation. It would be up to me to pick the guys to do the voices. Well, I was often the voice. You know?
Yeah.
I'm the letter W, you know. I am the letter B in things like boy. So I gave myself jobs at voiceover
because yeah.
I'd done a lot of that anyway, a lot of radio.
It's kind of great to see. Not everybody has, I get a little high-minded about it, about sketch or comedy in general. I love the idea of being able to use your comedy for the betterment of other people. Not everybody not all sketch or not all comedy is for that, but you got to actually realize that potential, and that's kind of wonderful.
Yeah. I really, I began to take it as a problem solving. You know?
Yeah.
How can we teach them and they won't realize they're being taught? It's more like entertainment.
Yeah.
And my wife, who is 26 years younger than me, and she was too. She already knew how to read. She'd come home from school. Maybe she was, I don't know how old she was, 15. She'd watch The Electric Company just for the ideas.
Yeah.
Just for the characters. So I hope that would be. I'll give an example. They wanted me to have a character who called in on the phone and complained about the language. If READ is read, what is READ? And why is READ also red? And why is READ red? It's confusing. So it was a guy who complained about the English language. What are you talking about? You people don't even know what you're talking about. So I created a guy, a call-in guy, and I named him J. Arthur Crank, based on something nobody knew but me, J. Arthur Rank Productions from London. a guy who had his own series of, he was a studio.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever seen an old movie like that, but a guy in a loincloth was in gold. He's painted gold or bronze. Mm-hmm. He came in with a big hammer and he had a big gong. It's a J. Arthur Rank production.
Amazing.
So I did that for myself.
Uh-huh.
Or anybody my age or say anybody older.
Sure.
But it didn't cost anything because J. Arthur Crank is funny.
Yeah.
With an initial, a guy named Crank, who's a crank caller.
It's perfect. I love it.
Anyway, that was something I tried to figure out also. I had a teacher who was teaching kids. Oh, I read in a magazine about something to do with teaching reading, that the teacher had a sign in the front of her desk. This would be kindergarten. It said desk. And in the window, it said window and door, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just a few things.
Yeah.
So I took it further, and she had a sign around her neck, said teacher. And trash.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole lot of them, some of them were quite funny. But she couldn't get the kids to pay attention at one scene in one episode. So they kept looking out the window. She couldn't figure what they're looking at, or they just distracted. So you cut away from her, and pretty soon you now go and see what's outside the window. It's a teacher now teaching out there through the window. That's where they're looking anyway. So that's one thing I developed. I also developed the idea of, I left there after the first year and they continued. I don't know if they ever used it. But I wanted to have, we only had, had about seven actors, and we had kids who were in the little singing group.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't the same ages, so the adult actors, you know, probably in their 20s or 30s.
Sure.
So if they were going to be the ones doing the sketches in the school, so I wanted to have mannequins in the school, you know, sitting at other desks.
Yeah.
And to make fun of it, because when the teacher would say, she tells them the assignment, and the kids and the our actors are writing their assignment, and they look puzzled and they lean over to the mannequin as if they could get information.
I love it.
They so treated good. The mannequins like real.
And I like that things like that are always going to inform your sense of humor if you're an attentive kid too. So that's an extra level of the kind of stuff that another way you're influencing a generation of people. That's amazing.
Well, I found it very rewarding to know that I had done something that might help.
Yeah. Do you, can you remember the first person you might have met? So, like maybe the first comedy album you bought? I'm assuming you've met a good deal of people whose albums you owned. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, the people who are most prominent today are not at my age level.
Sure.
I knew more character actors than I do comedians, but I do know many, many improvisers because a typical thing in Chicago is you're there for 4 or 5 years, and then you say, I've done this for a while. I'm going to go to L.A. My friends are getting parts in sitcoms, and others are writing sitcoms. Yeah. A lot of improvisers became writers out here. And so you come here, and then there's not enough work for you. Because even though you're good at improvising, that doesn't always mean you'll be hired for dramatic parts or even comedy parts.
Yeah.
Sometimes, but a lot of them, almost too many improvisers in L.A. now.
Yes.
So they started doing shows down in the promenade, and once a group I worked with went to the Friars Club, which was an old conventional
amazing
comedy show place in a club in Beverly Hills. Well, they had a night where they didn't have very many people come, so they would put us on. They wouldn't pay us, but we'd bring our friends, and they would have something going on in the club, and they'd sell some liquor. And it was a version of what they call the Herald in the Second City, which is you take one suggestion and do a whole evening or do a whole. So they would put an email out and 35 or 40 of us came.
Mm-hmm.
So we put the numbers in a hat and picked a number. You're in group 1, 2, 3, 4. And we'd have 4 shows of a half hour each.
Okay.
And the rest of the time, 3/4 of us are in the audience watching. We're audience. So we never had to play to nobody.
Yeah.
But they'd be great people like Ryan Stiles and Dan Castaneda.
Yeah.
Great, great, great improvisers.
Oh, my God. And,
I did that off and on for 4 or 5 years also.
That's wonderful.
I haven't heard from him in a while, but Ryan Stiles is one of the great ones.
Yeah. Holy
You've
cow.
Seen him on Whose Line?
Sure. Man, that's so wonderful.
I was once doing a scene And he ran on stage and says, "Blood, we need more blood." And they left. But that's not what the scene was about. So he brought his own scene in. And then he went away, and that was the end of that part. But it was funny.
That's great. You know what? So I could keep you here all day, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to... So your album, I recommend people hunt it down, but was it ever released on CD or anything, or is it just... It's just the LP?
No, it was not... To my knowledge, it was... Okay. I know that it was called Strand Records.
Yes, yeah.
But I don't know if they went out of business right afterwards.
Right. Maybe we'll have to look at a way
and because
to
I
that.
Was carrying my books on stage, I named the album Book Solid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had the setting in a bookstore for that reason.
It's great.
I made the title up.
It's worth listening to. I think people should hunt it down. And if it's not available that way, we should find a way to remedy that because I think people should be able to listen to that.
There's beat poetry in it. You know, there's a line I like where I say, one of my first apartments in New York was in a kind of a, not a street, but an alleyway. Next to me was a guy who's kind of a hippie, and the place he lived in used to be a stable. But with a little work and imagination, he had turned it into a pigsty. And sometimes I'd see him sitting on his front step, and he seemed so depressed and so dirty and disheveled and just out of it. I wanted to go over and put my arm around him and say, "Come on, buddy, tomorrow will be better." But I didn't want to touch him. There's some very funny lines.
It's a lot of fun. It's worth listening to. Is there anything coming up that we should tell people about? Or yeah.
Well, the next thing I'm doing is it's called a guest book, and I don't know. I think it's a cable show. I'm doing it in 2 weeks. And I think the guest on it is really playing a guest on it because I think each episode or each season, it's a beach house or it's a cabin by the lake or it's a bed and breakfast in the Victoria, and it's about being in a place staying with the guest.
Okay.
You'd be the guest.
Yeah.
So I'm playing, oddly enough, I had a table read the other day. I said to the director, "Did you know I was from West Virginia?" He said, "Yeah, I knew that. But I don't know if he wrote it first or he just found out
later." Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it's a guy who's 77 and he's been a coal miner all his life and he has black lung. And he's coming to see, and he only has a year left, the doctor told him. The Indian doc told me. Have a year left. And I thought I'd come out and see my only living relative. And so they're having a party that night. He said, "You're free to join us. You know, some of the people may be doing drugs." And he said, "What kind?" And he's thinking it's, you know, it's like little Tylenol. So all different drugs to make people happy. So, "Well, I'll join you. I never did that, but I'll give it a try." So he gets high. And it's a rather cute show. Orson Bean was in one, and he recommended me because we're friends.
That's great. Where do we see it?
I don't know. You'll have to look it up.
Okay. I will look it up and try and tag something to the end of this.
I've done this so long, I don't always know the venue.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, some people, when they get a job, they'll look on their computers. "Oh, that's Showtime." Well, I don't really care where they put it on. You know?
Yeah, I got to play.
At some point, I'll find out. I'll get a check from them.
Sure.
It'll be for Showtime. But I know it's cable. And I know that I watched... I looked it up and watched the pilot. My wife looked it up for me. I know that the first guest was Stockard Channing, so they had a pretty high level of talented people.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And Orson Bede did one. And I think they said to Orson, "We need a guy your age to do our next one," or something. Well, Paul Dooley's like me. He's older. We're about the same age. I've known him all my life. I was in college. I saw him in the Sullivan Show. He was a wonderful stand-up comic.
Yeah. I need to get his albums, actually.
His first line was, I just gave one away. It was called Orson Bean at the Hungry Eye. It was in San Francisco. And he, at the end of his act, used to make a paper eucalyptus tree, which is a magic trick where you go like this.
Oh, yeah.
And it looked like leaves. You take newspapers and fold them and tear them. That makes the leaves, and you bring it up like that. I remember he said, "This is an ancient trick, one of the oldest tricks in the world that magicians did." And he said, and way back to the ancient Greeks, in fact, that traditionally they used the New York Times. He had a very funny act. His first line was, "My name is Orson Bean, Harvard 48, Yale nothing." It's his opening line.
Love it.
He was a very funny guy.
My goodness, I have a million other questions for you. If you ever want to come back, maybe we'll find another way to have you back on, because this was a lot of fun.
And pretend to have another album.
Yeah, let's do
more
that.
Vinyl.
If I find that other album, if I could hunt that down, we're definitely talking about that. Because there are a lot of like parallel albums or knockoff albums of
well,
First
it would
Family
be around.
Too,
it was during the Kennedy administration.
Yeah. I'm gonna have to.
How long did Kennedy last? 3 years.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
It's in that time frame. Dee Caruso was one of the
Dee
writers.
Dee Caruso. All right.
Then later, I know he wrote sitcoms out here.
Okay. Because the name sounds very familiar, so I'm sure I've seen the name listed on something I was a fan of at some point. You know.
I just went to a studio and did it for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw them again.
It's crazy. They gave you your money.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny because they did albums. You know, they've still, well, during the era of LPs, there are a bunch of tax write-off albums. And whenever you hear about an album that didn't get produced or get distributed, you're like, was that a tax write-off? Did they just get some guy to perform? You know, like I've seen mostly music, but I don't know if there are any comedy albums that were like that. I want to know. I'm going to do some hunting. We're going to have to do some hunting. And anybody listening.
At that time, they seemed to be grabbing anybody who could do.
Yeah, of course.
Do 30 or 40 minutes.
Man, I would have done okay back then. I'd do an okay Jack Kenny. I look nothing like him. But on a record, I'd be fine. On a record, I would have been fine. That's wonderful. Seriously, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you guys for listening. That's really it. And as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.